God is not our idea of God. Let me say it again. God is not our idea of God. The human brain simply isn't vast enough to comprehend the fullness of the divine. A God that I can envision will always be an idol of my own making. This is not to say that the picture that you have of God rolling around in your head right now, that picture is entirely inaccurate. It just means that your picture of God will always be far more incomplete than complete. Because no matter how much you can know about God, there will always be infinitely more that you don't know about God. My friends, this is why preaching is so ridiculously, stupidly difficult. I mean, how can you even begin to express that which is inexpressible? How can you wrap finite words around an infinite God? For example, consider this. You and I, we have a past. We exist in this present moment, and Lord willing, we will have a future. But there is no such thing as the past to God. There is no such thing as the future to God, nor is there such a thing as the present moment to God, because God is not constrained or limited by time like we are. So not only is Christ present to us right here, right now, he is also equally present to the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren and the great-great-grandchildren and so on that the people here in the pews have yet to beget. And Christ is also equally present to our ancestors, just as present to them as he is to us in this present moment, this thing we call the present moment, at least. Because past, present, and future are nothing to God. Consider our mind-bending reading from just a few weeks ago, the last Sunday of Epiphany, the reading about Jesus' transfiguration. Do you remember how that story goes? Jesus took a couple of his disciples from his posse to the top of Mount Tabor to pray. While he was praying, he was transfigured before them. His face, his body became luminous with the glory of God. Then, to accommodate our feeble minds, the scriptures tell us that Moses and Elijah also appeared to Jesus in that moment as well. But as St. John Cassian taught long, long ago, it wasn't Moses and Elijah who appeared to Jesus on the top of that mountain. No, no. It was Jesus who appeared to Moses and Elijah. For those of you who didn't flunk Sunday school or get kicked out of Bible camp growing up, you know that somewhere around 1400-ish years before Jesus' birth, Moses experienced God's presence on top of Mount Sinai when he received the Ten Commandments from God. And then somewhere around 1,000 years before Jesus was born, the prophet Elijah experienced God speaking to him on top of Mount Horeb. And then somewhere around 30 years or so after Jesus' birth, Moses and Elijah appeared to Jesus on top of Mount Tabor at his transfiguration. We see these things as being three entirely different, separate events, divided by vast amounts of time and space, right? But according to John Cassian, these are not three separate events at all. They're actually one event. On top of Mount Tabor, Christ appeared to Moses on Mount Sinai, and he spoke to Elijah on Mount Horeb. Moses and Elijah didn't appear to Christ in the present moment as much as Christ appeared to them in the past. So as Christ was transfigured on top of Mount Tabor, he was reaching back into time, back in time, calling both Moses and Elijah to follow him. What appears to us as three different stories in the scriptures, it's actually one story to Christ. Engage the mystery of his incarnation even further with me, my friends. Was Jesus baptized in the River Jordan because that's the spot where the Hebrew people crossed over into the Promised Land some 1,400 years before his baptism? Or did the Hebrew people cross the River Jordan because that's the spot where Jesus was baptized 1,400 years later? Which is it? The baptism of Christ and the parting of the waters of the Jordan River, they appear to us as being two separate events in history, but again, they are one event to Christ. Now, if this is true, then it means that the moment the Hebrew people crossed the Jordan River, and the moment that Jesus was baptized in the Jordan River, and the moment a priest sprinkled water over your head at your baptism, these were all one moment to Christ, not three. Did Jesus die on the cross because Isaiah wrote about it? Or did Isaiah write about it because Jesus died on the cross? Did the blood of the Passover lamb in Egypt cause the shedding of Jesus' own blood on a cross some 1,400 years later? Or did the shedding of Jesus' blood on a cross cause the events of Passover to take place some 1,400 years earlier? Are you following me so far? If so, let's fall even further into the mystery, my friends. Let me throw a question at you. How do you answer it? What was Christ doing before he became incarnate? What was Christ doing before he was born of a Virgin Mary in Bethlehem? Most Christians today would say that he existed as God in a pre-incarnate, disembodied, purely spiritual state, and in that pre-incarnate, disembodied, purely spiritual state, he revealed himself to the people of Israel all down through their history. In other words, before Jesus was born of Mary, he revealed himself in a theophany to Moses in the burning bush, and he wrestled with Jacob, and he stood in a fiery furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he revealed his glory to Ezekiel, things like that. But here's the question. Is there such a thing as before for Christ? Is there such a thing as before for the one who is called Alpha and Omega, who himself is the beginning and the end? Is there such a thing as before for the one who is not at all constrained by time? The answer is no. Mystery of mysteries, there was no before the incarnation. The moment Christ became incarnate, the moment he was born of the Virgin Mary, that was the very moment he also started to appear to people like Moses and Elijah and Jacob and David and Daniel and the people of Israel. During his earthly life, Jesus didn't just call the disciples and people like Mary and Martha and the woman at the well to follow him. He also called people like Moses to be his lawgiver, and Elijah to be Israel's prophet, and Abraham to bless the whole world, and David to be Israel's king, and Eve to be the mother of the living, and Hannah to place her faith in him. This, my friends, is why the hearts of the disciples were completely lit ablaze with passion in his presence. Once Jesus opened the scriptures to them after his resurrection, they suddenly realized that Christ the Word had been speaking to them and to their ancestors simultaneously as they followed him all around Galilee. And this is how they came to know that this Jesus, he wasn't just Israel's Messiah. He was the universe's God. As the psalmist has said, God has spoken once, twice have I heard it. That power belongs to God. So while Jesus was being tempted in the wilderness, he was the luminous cloud of glory guiding the people of Israel as they wandered through their wilderness. And as the people of Jerusalem sang their hosannas over him on Palm Sunday, the glory of Yahweh fell for the first time upon King Solomon's temple. But we're so much like Peter in the gospel today, are we not? Our idea of who Jesus is, that actually is the thing that blinds us to who Jesus actually is. Jesus, you are the Messiah. You can't suffer. You are the Messiah. You can't be crucified and rejected. You are the Messiah. You can't die like the rest of us. Still, 2,000 years later, and we have yet to understand the victory of Jesus' cross and just how much he has trampled down death by his death. Jesus' death on a cross and your grandfather's death, was that one death or two? Jesus' death on a cross and your best friend's death, was that one death or two? Jesus' death on a cross and your mother's death, one death or two? Jesus' death and the death of your child, one death or two? Jesus' death and the death of your grandchild, one death or two? Jesus' death and the death of your spouse, is that one death or two? Jesus' death and the death you will one day die, one death or two? As Saint Athanasius taught, the death that Jesus died was our death. If his death is your loved one's death, and if your loved one's death is his death, and if his death is your death, and if your death is his death, then what, my friends, does that make his empty tomb?